We welcome back to the program, as we do each Tuesday at this time, author Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
How's it going, Kimball?
Fabulous, thank you, fabulous. I know you like the cold, you respect the cold, but where do you draw the line? We're looking at 21 below this Friday night.
Oh, really? Yeah. I don't think that's what I'm looking at this Friday night. That sounds like a you thing. Is that a Maine thing?
It's a Maine. It is a Maine thing. Oh, yeah, you don't want that.
No, that's just on its own. That's not like the wind or
fields
in the neighborhood of. That's the actual, is that even possible?
Yeah.
The actual temperature?
And when you factor in the wind chill factor is going to be between 40 and 50 below.
Oh, that sounds like if you go outside with your arm exposed, something bad happens to you, right? So it doesn't even sound possible. Okay, so my line is at zero by the thermometer. If it's above zero and I get in stairs, and I'm not going to do a huge amount with a rest, but just to do a straight half hour, I think it's going to be somewhere around 2 degrees on Saturday here, so we'll see. But it hasn't been cold at all, really. I don't feel like winter exists much anymore the way it used to.
No, and I guess that's what makes it stand out, is that there were times when being below zero here in the Northeast would not be even worthy of mention. But the winters have become quite mild and short. And I'm like you, I like the cold. The wind, when you plug that in, I can do without the wind and I can do without the ice. Bring me the snow, I'll take the cold. I like walking on a nice brisk winter's day, but I don't like that wind that cuts right through you.
You mean non-rink and non-pond ice.
Yes.
Sneaky ice.
Right.
Underfoot. A guy like you goes down. Oh, no! And you're still at that age where you'll be fine. You break it.
I don't bounce up like I used to, Colin.
No, you don't?
No, I roll over and do an inventory. Everything's still working? Okay, I can get up now. Unless, of course, someone's watching. You know, like a younger person who might see me fall, and then that's fine. Don't you worry about me, and I'll save the aches and pains for later.
I should do a public service announcement then. Watch me succumb in this very method before next week. But all you people out there, be careful on stairs. I've been receiving a number of stories from people about people dying on stairs. It's not that hard, apparently, to die on the stairs or to knock yourself out or have something. A friend of mine at his kid's school, a guy had a heart attack, a teacher had a heart attack on the stairs, which is bad enough in and of itself. But that's not what killed him. What killed him was when he had the heart attack, he hit his head.
Yeah.
It sounds like he might have succumbed anyway, just by the trippage rather than the heart attack. So, yeah, careful on stairs. Now, I say that to myself, Colin can't be with us. There's been a tragedy at City Hall. He wrecked. Like, but if he was ever going to go away, that was by his own hand. It makes sense that he died on his beloved stairs. So let me just say that now, because I don't want to give God or Satan, whoever's in charge of these things, any ideas between now and next Tuesday.
I think you've covered yourself. I think you're in good shape there. Well, let's see. On the docket today, number of things to talk about. Let's begin with a really fun session from... Apparently, it was a radio appearance in Stockholm in 1967. The Byrds with Jim, not quite yet, Roger McGuinn. That was a fascinating conversation, and then some great music as well.
Another one of the first bootlegs I owned that wasn't by the Beatles. And something that really struck me about this, in addition to the music and sound quality, it was peak era Byrds, 1967. I was entranced by the between song patter of the Byrds. I always liked that about the Beatles' BBC sessions, almost as much as the music was everything that was said and on the bootlegs and the vinyl bootlegs at the Beeb. And there were all of these before the bootleg label Purple Chick existed. The cover art would boast with Beatle chat. So this is with Bird chat. And it just stuck with me. McGuinn introduces, so you want to be a rock and roll star. That's something that's even like factored into my work now. He describes the methodology, the thinking behind writing the song. He says, we wanted to present a kind of kit for people if they wanted to go out and be a rock and roll star. And that's really the form that the song takes, is this kid. And when I was working on something like this Beatles book, which is a piece-by-piece guide to becoming the ultimate thinking person's Beatles fan, I thought of it, those words were kind of in my head. I thought of it as a kit that you'd give to readers, that they would read and they would think differently and they would listen differently and they would process the Beatles differently and they would come from different angles, but you'd given them the kit, like when your dad puts together the bike on Christmas morning type of thing. So it's not a long running bootleg. It's just this one air shot. So it's in the 20-minute area. But people would say that the Byrds couldn't play live. Mm. One of those misconceptions in rock and roll. I think we've addressed a few of them, the idea of so many pertaining to the Grateful Dead. But that's definitely one that's true about the Byrds. Now, the Byrds by 1970 were an incredible live band. But even in 66, 67, especially 67, they could bring it in that live arena. So this is a pretty good example of that.
Yeah, it's a terrific listen. Check that out from 1967. And then a wonderful performance of Stars Fell on Alabama, Billie Holiday, in 1957.
Right. So in 57, Billie Holiday is getting close to her end, which is going to come in the midpoint of 1959. And normally when people talk about Billie Holiday, the people who do, who know her music somewhat, who aren't just using her as a kind of cultural reference for some agenda-driven point that they want to make without really knowing what her art was about, they'll focus on the sessions that she made in the 30s and the 40s and really kind of stay clear of this period, the entire 1950s, let alone this late in her game. But in January of 1957, Billie Holiday made some of the best music of her life. And part of the reason for that was she had cut a number of sessions over a long period of time with strings. And Billie Holiday was an artist almost like Elvis. Elvis functioned best when he had a small, tight unit around him. And sometimes we don't consider how strong, for instance, someone like Scotty Moore was on guitar. And when you listen to like Elvis with his trio early on, you hear how tight the band was. Well, that's how Billie Holiday was in January of 1957. She had this small group setting that she'd been restored to. And the musicians she was with were all just the highest caliber of jazz musicians. And the thing that's cool about Billie Holiday, like we think of hockey, we think of players who have intangibles. As a singer, she had intangibles. She had a way, and Miles Davis was this way as a trumpet player. She had a way of impacting how the people around her seemed to play, the levels that they would rise to, and that would make her rise to other levels. So it's really her at her best. It's her best music, I should say, even if her voice had weathered some. But you don't want to overlook Billie Holiday in January 1957 if you want to understand what she was about artistically.
And it seemed, well, it was in many ways the end of her career and her life just a couple of years later, but she was only about, what, 39, 40 years old when she recorded this?
Yeah, she dies at, what, 44. So She was like one of those people, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Edgar Allan Poe, Billie Holiday, all going out kind of around the same time, Van Gogh. And I guess they have certain things in common, too, as I list those names. They were people who lived hard in the one sense, but also lived hard in their art. And maybe you can do one or the other, but not both. And you have to find a way to separate those two things so you can put everything that you are into your work, but also take care of yourself at the same time. And she had an idea for quite a while that she wasn't going to make it that far. And it's something that she was open about and maybe somewhat of a self-fulfilling prophecy. But then again, she also did not keep herself in the best condition. And then we can hear that to a degree in her voice. But at the same time, there wasn't anything that was going to get in the way of that voice
emoting the way that it needed to emote to bring that art to that level that it ultimately did reach.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. From there, we move to a BBC production of a Sherlock Holmes tale, The Engineer's Thumb, featuring Carlton Hobbs. And I don't think I had heard Carlton Hobbs as Holmes before. And he was terrific. And he did, as I did a little research, did a number, about 80 radio adaptations of Holmes. He was fantastic.
I think we did talk about him once before. I'm up to my hips and links for the site as I redo large parts of it, so I've been seeing a bunch of old things. I think that came up. But Carlton Hobbs, he didn't do the complete run as Holmes. That's only been done once with Clive Merrison as Holmes. But he came, like you said, awfully close. And I don't know if I want to commit to this yet, but I'm edging closer to it. He might be my favorite Sherlock Holmes.
Merrison
is up there. Jeremy Brett, Basil Rathbone is kind of a sentimental choice for me. I don't think he necessarily embodies the character the way that Merrison and Jeremy Brett do. They lend him an acerbic aspect that I think was central to Holmes. But as Carlton Hobbs, man, he is really grown on me over the years. And you know what? I think it's unfair. I think this is inaccurate. When you read about Carlton Hobbs as Holmes, you'll see these descriptions that he was avuncular, that he was uncle-like. It doesn't sound that way to me. He sounds like pretty close to how I think Holmes was in the stories. And this is a really cool story itself. We've talked in the past about weird art and how weird art is great so long as weird art works. That's my little phrase. And this is about a guy who gets his thumb hacked off and he comes in on the train in the morning. He's had this misadventure really bad the night before. And he says to the guy, like the porter on the train, he says, "No, a doctor." And the guy knows Watson. He takes him around to Watson's and he sits down and Watson looks at this. I mean, it's really gory. It's one of the more gory things in all of the Holmes canon. And this must be a horrible accident you've had. The guy's like, "No, it was no accident. He had after me with a cleaver." And Watson says, "Well, I know the perfect guy. He loves stuff like this." I go around to Holmes' place because Watson and Holmes don't live together anymore. They're not roommates. And so to get to the bottom of what happened here, there are no arrests. There's nothing like that. Holmes is so often not driven by trying to solve a crime and bring someone to justice so much as he is by curiosity. He has a lot in common with Orson Welles that way. Orson Welles would undertake projects to see if he could do them, if they were possible, not even really looking sometimes at the finished artistic product, but for the challenge to satiate that curiosity. So he was quite Holmesian that way, or Holmes was quite Wellesian, but I think Carlton Hobbs embodies that nicely.
And I don't know who played Watson, but he was terrific too.
Yeah, he's always in these, Norman Shelley, he's always in these with Carlton Hobbs, and they're a great duo. And it's been what I've had on the past couple of weeks when I've been going to bed, because like you said, they did do so many of these episodes, and they're the episodes from Conan Doyle. A lot of the Rathbone and Bruce radio episodes, just like their films, but obviously they're more radio episodes, a lot of them are invented. They're not from the actual stories. There are a few. But these are from the stories, and they omit certain parts. Like, for instance, in this one and all the other versions, in the text of The Engineer's Thumb, the guy, when he's at Watson's, we don't get it here, but in Watson says something to him, he triggers the guy. It's a classic triggering. And the guy freaks out so much, I said a stressful time of it, that Watson has to scream at him to shut up, to knock it up. He's like had this panic attack. It's really emotionally intense. It's pretty crazy. And so this was like the BBC Light program. So when the Beatles were first on the BBC, like in 62, it was the BBC Light program. I mean, for all I know, for all anyone knows now, you could have heard something like this before the Beatles came on with Pete Best to do a Roy Orbison number in spring of 62. So I like that to it. It is continuous with what you would have gotten if you're really into the Beatles, you like setting the place and the time, the feel and the vibe. This is also good for that.
All right. Speaking of Orson Welles, a wonderful episode of The Shadow. And I think I've told you before, The Shadow was the show that got me hooked on old time radio. When I was a kid, a local radio station began airing episodes of The Shadow every night, and I would listen to those religiously, and nothing better than hearing Orson Welles as Lamont Cranston, and of course, Margot Lane. Who didn't love Margot Lane?
It's good, can't be fun, and I would say, maybe you'll agree, it doesn't hold up quite as well artistically.
No.
Some of the other radio that we've discussed, and one of the drawbacks, I'd say, of The Shadow is the hyper level of exposition. Someone gets shot, they narrate everything.
Right.
I may be dying, but I probably have 2 minutes left. They really, they go through it like that, and someone looks at someone else and something's happened to them, and I see that you've twisted your ankle, but not so much that you can't still continue on at a sufficient pace to get out of the room before the water rises. Oh, it's at 1 foot now. And so there's a lot of that clunkiness in the writing. And also, if you happen to miss the origin of The Shadow and you came along later on in the series, you might not really understand what The Shadow is doing or is able to do. What really happened was The Shadow, he went off the grid for a while. And he did some research, and he learned some stuff, like in India and the Orient. Remember our story, the monkey's paw? He
right.
probably did some stuff with that. And he comes back, and he can teleport his mind. It's a little confusing. He's not actually there, but he's kind of there. And it gets campy when Orson Welles, the Shadow, he's Lamont. He's talking to Margot, and then he just switches. And keep a listen out for The Shadow in case he tries to reach you. We're doing third person now. I've switched. It was abrupt. Deal with it, lady. And I always like that, too, because I'm thinking, rein it in, Shadow. You're a little self-aggrandized. Like, you just be cool, man. You just have some humility.
Well, this is a fun episode from 1938, The Society of the Living Dead.
Yeah, and I think that has to be, he's not announced at the end, but it has to be Fred Flintstone, who is the chief villain. And it would seem that it couldn't be Fred Flintstone because he was born in, I think, 1907. So when Fred Flintstone was on, yeah, he was like 55. I don't think people thought of like Fred Flintstone. That way. But yeah, it's fun. You get all of the organ, the Wurlitzer, you get that effect. I mean, they're certainly not stinting. You think they were getting paid by the organ note sometimes with some of these old time radio shows. But it's fun, and it's, I think, probably for a lot of people, like what you said, it's a gateway radio program, because when I listen to it now, I listen to it for the Orson Welles factor. I don't really listen to other episodes of The Shadow that he's not in. This is 1938, like you said, and he's doing a lot of stuff, obviously, with the Mercury. The radio by the middle and the end of that year. I hear it now as something that was meant for children, and other radio programs that you hear that clearly weren't. Like, a surprising amount of the radio programs we've spoken about were intended at the time for adults. Quiet Please was for adults. Johnny Dollar was for adults. Gunsmoke was for adults. And Gunsmoke would be billed as the radio program for mature listeners. The Shadow's not that. The Shadow's
no.
Saturday matinee kind of kid stuff, I think.
And I'm pretty sure one of the voices I heard was Welles' collaborator in a number of things, including Citizen Kane, Everett Sloan.
Yeah, he turns up in a lot of, it's the troop, it's the gang.
Mm.
And so Welles kept people close to him, especially during these years, especially during the late 30s and on to the early 1940s, the RKO years. And
Finally this afternoon, first episode of the 1981 adaptation of Star Wars. Fascinating story behind it. It was a collaboration between NPR, the BBC, but with a whole lot of help and a support from George Lucas himself.
And a whole lot that is not in the film. Awful lot. I really enjoy these radio productions. And the first one, for the first film, rather, is by far the longest. It adds hours of story to the story, and it has a lot of the original actors. Not all of them, but a lot. And I think what's pretty cool about this particular installment from that first series, how much like American Graffiti it is. I think American Graffiti is this remarkable film that gets overlooked. Anytime I watch it, we talk about rewatchability. Rio Bravo, Out of the Past, American Graffiti. You can watch them over and over and over and over again. I know your favorite film is Rear Window, and I think one of the reasons that's so successful, maybe more successful than other Hitchcock pictures, like Psycho, for instance, is you can watch it again and again. Mm-hmm.
Well, you mentioned American Graffiti, and I watched that for years. I watched that every year on the last night before school starts, because to me, it's the greatest movie about the last night of summer vacation.
And that's kind of what this is, this radio version of Star Wars. Luke Skywalker is kicking around his old hometown, and he's not having a good time. He wants to cut loose and get out of there. And his buddy, like an upperclassman type of guy, you know how like when you're a freshman or a sophomore, you like look up to a junior or the senior or on your hockey team or whatever. They're like these gods. And this guy Biggs comes back, and he's been off having these adventures, and they're trying to restart their friendship, going down to like the Parks and Rec version. The power station is this cosmic version of that. And it's when you try to restart a friendship, they don't always sort of pick up where they left off. You've been in a different place in life. They've been in a different place in their life. And there's some tension between these two guys, although they still have a real fondness for each other. And I think it's very believable that way, in an American Graffiti, American high school kind of way. You have some people are quasi-bullies almost. You have people ripping on people. And it doesn't get off the ground, so to speak. We don't go to space. We're on this rock the entire time, and for a lot of the subsequent episodes, but of Tatooine. And I don't know. I think it's something that it has a different feel than we get with the first film. I mean, I count the first film as the only worthwhile, artistically speaking, film in the bunch. I think it's one of the best films ever made, and I think the others are, I mean, I'm fond of them. But I don't think they're anywhere close to that level, that self-contained, autonomous, effective level. But if you listen to all the hours of this 1981 production, you get all of this story that's just not there. And you know what's weird about that is I never hear anyone talk about this. Like if you said to Star Wars people, for instance, hey, there's this thing out there with Mark Hamill and Anthony Daniels, and it adds hours to the story, They would think you were pulling their leg. They wouldn't even think that's true. And yeah, it's right there. It's been right there for 40 years.
And I love reading about that John Houseman was involved, at least in getting it started as well. And then Lucas was so excited about it that he was willing to basically give them the rights. I think it was for, what, $1 an episode, plus allow them to use the music and the sound effects from the films.
The sound effects play well on the radio. Mm. I mean, that's a given. A lot of the times when we're talking about something like The Shadow, the sound effects are largely that organ. And that organ has become this radio cliche. And we talk about the best radio programs, the Gunsmoke. And a big reason why Gunsmoke is so effective, and there are a lot of things. There's the acting, and there are certainly the scripts. The scripts are like the songs. The Beatles would have only gone so far if they didn't have the songs. Gunsmoke would only go so far without the scripts. But you have to put that script into motion. And the sound effects are a big part of that. So Star Wars sound effects lend themselves
to the radio. And I think it underscores that idea that when George Lucas was at his best as a filmmaker, he was making more out of a kind of intimacy, a smallness. You can make so much out of so little in some ways when you're really on your game. I'd say that's how the best art is. You get that more from less, paradoxically. When you become maximalist, you lose the connection, you lose the intimacy, and it becomes pose and spectacle. And that's what's going to happen the further he gets thematically and aesthetically from his first real successful picture in American Graffiti. And I think Star Wars was an extension of that feeling, of that idea of community building up a picture and making it something, not just to enjoy watching the once, but to come back to again and again.
Next week when Colin visits, looking forward to this, we will talk Beatles.
We will talk Beatles on, what is it, February 7th? Because on February 11th, 1963, the Beatles recorded their entire first album in a 585-minute session. And what's really interesting about this is, if you know where to look, it's not hard to find, you can hear a lot of what they recorded on that day but did not release. You really get a fly on the wall viewpoint for the Beatles trying to make their way in this world.
Yeah, monumental day in the history of music. We'll talk about it with Colin Fleming next week here on Downtown. Thank you, Colin.
All right. See you later.